Thanks for tuning in this Sunday. We're going to talk about broadheads, warm weather meat care, and a little bit of scouting. David, you mentioned you had a horror story with mechanical. So let's start there.
Yes, this was many years ago. I was provided with a package of a very popular expandable broadhead at the time. I'm not going to mention who they are because they've done a lot of advancements, and this was like a Gen 1 or 2 expandable. But anyway, I took a shot at a mule deer at 55 yards.
Totally within your comfort range.
Yeah, completely in the comfort range. Hit him right in the chest, caught a little bit of the shoulder blade and a rib.
Yep.
And I thought, okay, he's going down. So he disappeared into the brush, and I gave him a little bit. Went in there, couldn't find him, started getting dark. I pulled out. We came back in the morning and figuring we're going to find, you know, a downed animal.
Right.
We get in there and get about, you know, 60 yards from where I hit it, and this thing jumps up and starts just motoring across the flat.
No limping or anything?
Oh, yeah, no, his left shoulder was, his leg was just like
flopping around.
Oh, yeah, it was just flopping around, and he'd been bleeding pretty good. Long story short, finally stocked up on him, you know, about two or so hours later, got my fixed blade broadhead, my slick trick, and finished it off. The expandable broadhead never opened. It was like shooting him with
a field point, basically.
Yeah, so when I hit that hard, because it was a hit on contact expandable.
A rear deploying or?
No, so it didn't rear deploy. So when it hits, it, you know, it takes a lot of kinetic energy to open that thing because it has to go up against the force of the arrow. So it's opening to the animal.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
You know, the older style. And there's still a lot out there that are like that. So it hit the bone and just wrapped itself around the shaft of the broadhead.
Oh,
it didn't
open
at all. I mean, the little rubber gasket was still on the back of the broadhead.
So,
with all the new technology out there, I'm still super bitter. I got this bitter taste in my mouth about trying to use an expandable again. And now they got some of those really cool ones that they don't open up until they're inside the animal.
Right.
You know, that would be the one I would use if I was to use them again. But you know, the thing is I've had so much success with my slick tricks, my four-blade 100-grain slick trick.
The slick trick standards, yep.
Yeah, I've shot anywhere, things from pigs to antelope to elk to desert sheep. I mean,
they work.
It does the trick. So it's like we were talking earlier, like if it's not broke, don't fix
it.
You know?
I live by that. Yeah. I'm so, like you. I swear by the slick tricks. Knock on wood, I don't have a horror story with mechanicals. Going into mechanicals a little bit, I brought up some of them. There's the rear deploying, forward deploying, and then
hybrids.
You have the hybrid where it's like kind of a fixed, but it has a couple blades that open. I have used successfully, and I actually kind of liked it, a Schwacker.
Yes.
I believe that's how you pronounce it.
The Schwackers. Yeah. Those are the ones that have the, it's like a little
micro blade thing
on the back. And then as it hits the back of the shaft or the back of the broadhead, the blades open up inside the animal, so you're getting through bone and hide and stuff that can sometimes
hang them up.
Know, hang things up. Yeah.
And the deer
those are awesome.
The deer I shot with that Schwacker, it actually went through two ribs, complete pass through, and was buried in the stump of like a bitterbrush thing about five feet past the animal. It was buried a good 2-3 inches in there. But here's my caveat on mechanical stuff, and I think you would agree with me. It's a situation-dependent broadhead, and by that, I mean, for a guy like me, I'm shooting a 70-pound speed bow, a 500-grain arrow. I've got a 29-inch draw length. You know, I'm going to punch through anything.
Yeah, no doubt. You've got the kinetic energy there with that 500-grain arrow to
punch
through. You're going to be fine, yeah.
Now, if you take like my wife shooting 45-ish pounds, 26-inch draw length, lighter, like a 430-grain arrow, I'm probably going to stick with a slick trick on something like that.
Most definitely. I would definitely stay with a fixed broadhead with when you're using lower poundages.
Yes.
There's a big misnomer there. There's a lot of talk out there about, well, you know, my wife or my son or my daughter, whoever, is shooting a 45-pound bow, so I'm going to go to expandables because they're better. No. Depending on the type of expandable it is, those things absorb a great deal of that kinetic energy to open.
Right.
And if you don't have it from the get-go, you're going to have a lot less on impact. And I've seen situations where great shot, it goes in 6-7 inches.
Right.
Because there's just not enough oomph.
Most of the arrow hanging out of the animal as it runs off. Yeah.
As it's running off. I mean, if it's a decent shot, you're going to catch a lung, but it's that animal is going to travel quite a distance, depending on what animal it is.
Well, yeah, a bull elk.
Oh, yeah.
It's going one lung down, it's going miles.
It'll definitely cover a lot of distance. So, but yeah, I would definitely go to a fixed blade broadhead and something probably with a smaller cutting diameter, like, you know, for Nevada, the legal limit is 7/8 of an inch at its widest point.
Right.
I would do something like that for a lower poundage, shorter draw length shooter.
Couldn't agree more with you on that. And I think this kind of leads me into my next point, which would be broadhead tuning, using a big enough vane to actually get the arrow rotating and everything, overcoming the fixed blade broadhead kind of steering the arrow. And I've got a personal story about this. One year, my dad was having a heck of a time with some fixed blade broadheads and them flying straight. Well, we checked the bow tune and everything, and he was running blazer vane. So, okay, got enough vane on there. Well, what was happening is the broadhead he was using, when I took a slow motion video with my iPhone, you could see that arrow start to kind of plane as soon as it left the bow, and then it would start, then finally the vanes took over. But where I'm going with that is make sure I run like a 2-degree offset, you know, make sure you've got like a helical or something. And if you're running these smaller, the popular heat vanes or something low profile,
right,
and you got a big, you know, 1¼-inch fixed blade broadhead on the front of that thing, that broadhead can kind of plane out and steer your arrow. You'll get some funky flight stuff.
Yeah, and with that, you just got to make sure you're spin tuning those things. You've got a really good, smooth spin on them. And me personally, I prefer the mid to low profile vanes, but longer.
What do you run on your hunting arrows?
Right now, I am running the Q2s.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm running a 3-inch Q2, and it's the mid-range in regards to height. It's not the low profiles, and it's not the big fatties.
Okay.
It's mid-range. And I do that because the really tall ones, the big tall vanes, if you end up having a situation where you've got a little breeze or wind or what have you, there's a lot more service area sticking out there, and just the mid-range to low profile ones seem to fly best for me, especially when, you know, I'm shooting broadheads at 60, 70 or 80 yards when I'm practicing.
Right.
You know, making sure that all my distances are hitting the target.
You know, you bring up a really good point. Shooting it at realistic distances. Now, you may not take a shot at 80 yards, but you're comfortable doing that. And I would make sure people know, like, hey, don't get a new set of broadheads. Go out, shoot one broadhead from the package on one arrow at a target at 20 yards and say, hey, this is good. You need to be shooting them at 50, 60 yards, making sure nothing funky shows up in the flight farther down range.
Oh, yeah, because at 20 yards, your arrow's not going to come to full spin.
Right.
It's not going to start, you know, that consistent revolution of the arrow from the vanes. So you need to push it back a bit and let that arrow, you know, come out to like nice cruising altitude or cruising speed. Cruising speed. So
time for a quick break. Don't touch that dial. When we come back, we're going to be talking warm weather meat care, and then we'll wrap up the show with some tips and tricks on scouting.
We'll be right back.
So it's that time of year. Everybody's starting to get out and scout. You know what you got. You knew what you drew. You know where you are going to be hunting. Let's skip to you got an animal on the ground. It's hotter than hell because it's Nevada. And let's say it's an early season archery or an antelope tag or something. We wanted to go into warm weather meat care. I know you've got kind of your methods, what you like to do, David. Why don't you drop some of those on me?
Well, you know, first thing I'd like to do is go through what I call my kill bag.
Okay, yeah.
So it's just basically like a small traveling shower bag that I acquired, and it goes in my backpack, and it's got everything I need to process an animal in the field.
What is that?
So I've got the I got a couple Havilands in there.
Okay.
With several blades. I've got three different types of blades. I have a skinning blade. I've got the opening it up blade, the gutting blade. If I go that route, sometimes I'll go the gutless method, depending on where I am.
How the animal fell.
How the animal fell. Do I have shade nearby? Do I need to do this like lickety split, like get this stuff and booger out of there type of thing? I've got a little saw in there, bone saw if I need it. Generally, I try my best not to use a bone saw because it takes up a lot of time. So, and then I got, you know, latex gloves in there. I've got my game bags in there. So everything's in this little, what I call my kill bag.
Yep.
And I go through that, make sure everything's in there. I got it all and I'm ready to rock and roll.
Okay.
So that's
the same thing. I just call it a kill kit. But
kill bag. Yeah.
Free plug for Granite Gear.
Yes.
They make ultralight backpacking little cubes. Yeah. And that's what they make, a little cube. It's about maybe 8 inches by 6 inches, maybe like 4 inches deep. And they make it in like a blaze orange, ultralight fabric. That's what all my stuff goes in.
Yeah.
And
it
same
works
thing.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah, but always make sure you've got that. Always make sure you've got a good system. You know, kind of go through it in your head. If you've never done it before, it's like your first year getting out there, you're taking the kids or you're just doing it yourself or what have you, I definitely recommend getting on YouTube or something and understanding how to do it. Because, you know, the first thing people want to do is they want to take pictures. Oh, my God, I just shot my first deer. I shot a big one, or I shot something.
Right.
I got it on the ground. I want to take some pictures. If you do truly like have to take pictures and it's hot out, make it quick.
Yes.
Make it real quick and then get into that animal and get it cooled off.
Yes. I'm the opposite. We talked in the Tim Burnett episode. Half the time I was good on that bear hunt I went on a while back about taking pictures, but half the time I'm bad. I went on a hunt last year. And I was helping somebody out. They got a deer. And before you know it, I'm like in the thing. I'm starting to cape it and everything. It's like, did anybody get... Oh, whoops. Yeah. I forgot to take pictures.
Yeah, I've done that myself. Because generally the first thing I do once I get to the animal and I know it's dead is I look for shade.
Yeah,
I'm looking
get it
for
to
a
shade.
Good shaded spot where I can drag it to, carry it to, whatever it is. And if I can't, I try to find a nice wedge spot in some bushes or something to where if I'm by myself to where I can get to processing that animal as quickly as possible, especially antelope, because antelope are so small, they will heat up real fast. And I've seen antelope, their meat go weird within an hour if you don't get in there and get to it.
Oh, and even if it doesn't go 100% weird, you know, it's visibly or it smells, you know, whatever, it'll still taste funky.
Oh, for sure.
No amount of seasoning will get it out.
No.
Yeah.
If you cook it and your dogs are like, no, you know you screwed up.
So I got a thing for the shade, another free plug for a company. He's a diehard backcountry hunter, super nice guy. It's Bora Gear, B-O-R-A-H Gear. He makes ultralight backpacking shelters and stuff, but he made me a tarp. And it stuffs down to like the size of a baseball. I'm generally hunting with trekking poles.
Yeah.
And all it does, there's little, they're not grommets. It's like sewn nylon loops. So you can make shade out there. You set the packs on one side, you stand up the trekking poles.
And you attach it.
Yep. And you just run a little stake out and bingo, you got shade.
Oh, that's sweet.
That's an extreme case. That's an antelope hunt case where there's not a tree for 20 miles and you got to make your own shade. Free plug for Bora gear.
That is awesome. I know. Yeah. I always carry like a small tarp, you know, yeah, like a 5x3 tarp.
Okay.
You know, you can fold them up pretty tiny and they yep generally fit like along the back part of your backpack, kind of lay it in there. I'll put the animal on that because okay one thing I hate is when you're trying to get the hide off and open it up and get some breathing in there and you're kicking dirt and you're trying to jump over the animal, try to get your best position.
Stepping over it.
And then the thing rolls a bit. And next thing you know, your animal's just covered in dirt and rocks. And
yeah, it's nasty. It's just, so we've talked the three big things: heat, moisture, and bugs/bacteria.
Yes.
That's what you want to avoid.
Yes.
So heat, get it in the shade.
Yep.
Get it out of the sun. Get the hide off as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
Cut with the hair. Somebody told me this one time, but flat to flesh, sharp to sky.
Yes.
So when you're running that knife down the back of the knife, the flat part is going to go to the flesh of the animal. The sharp side of the blade goes to the sky. Flat yep to flesh, sharp to sky.
Yep.
So the heat thing, you know, okay, you get the hide off and all that. What are you doing then?
After I've
got the hide off.
So I've got a side of the hide off. So yeah, first off, I'm determining if I'm going to do a full gut, quarter out, and pack out.
Okay, so
warm early season. If I have shade, I'm going to quarter it out and probably okay a little bit more than that, because obviously smaller pieces cool quicker.
Yes.
Especially when you're talking the hind end. So if I got a good hind quarter, I'll generally cut right down to the bone.
Okay.
And fillet that thing open.
Yeah. I've heard it referred to as butterflying.
Butterflying it.
Especially
yeah
with even elk, the bone's you can
in
do that.
Even if yeah the bone's still in, I'll just cut one side of it and I'll open it up to get that heat, start it cooling down. Because the hind end of a cow elk or elk in general is big.
Yep.
It's
A lot of heat retention in
yes
there. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And even some mule deer, I mean, it gets pretty big. But first thing I'm going to do is I am going to start from the neck. I'm going to get the hindquarters off first and get those opened up and hanging.
Right.
If I've got a tree or something by, if not, lay it on some bushes and open it up, get it inside the game bag so the flies and such are not getting to it. And then from there, I start working on into the smaller pieces. I'll get some of the internal stuff out, like your...
What, like the tenderloins and stuff
yes, yes,
and all
exactly
that, rib meat?
Took me a second there. Bing.
No, tenderloins.
Yeah, get the tenderloins out because they're internal, so they're going to hold heat a little more. So I'm
yep
going to get that stuff out, and then I'm going to start taking out
organs and all that.
Yeah, if I'm going to do that, you know, pull all that out, and then I'll take out the back straps, and then I'll work my way up and start getting all the neck meat out and the front quarters off and everything.
Okay. The hanging, so you brought up hanging. That's mm-hmm one thing I wanted to bring up because I've seen people do this. Early season hunts, a lot of people, and myself included, in my kill kit is a contractor bag.
Yes.
To just kind of set stuff on as
yes
I'm working.
Yeah.
Ground is an insulator. And especially in the sun, on a black plastic contractor bag, the hanging part is crucial.
Yes.
Get it in the game bag. Get it up hanging on something so that the air is circulating around it.
Mm-hmm.
Do not leave it. Don't think, okay, just because it's on the animal, maybe you're doing the bone out. You're getting all the meat off the bone. You think, okay, bone's out, meat's open, I'm good to go. Well, not quite. You want to get it hanging pretty
yeah
darn quick.
Yeah, you want to get that air all the way around it.
What kind of game bags do you use?
Over the years, I've collected so many different versions. I've won some. I've had some given to me. Man,
yeah.
I don't even got
a specific brand you like?
No, I've got like some big, heavy canvas ones.
The old school cotton.
Old school
yep
cotton ones. I've got those. Then I've got quite a few of the like almost like cheesecloth style.
Right,
but
okay.
Heavy duty, so you yeah can like put a fair amount in there. And that's what I'll use when I'm backpacking stuff out. Are
right
those. And then once I get to camp and I'm trying to get stuff, either if I hang it in the shade overnight, like you said, because even in August when you're up in the monitors or up in, you know, Arc Dome Wilderness or something, the nights you're getting plenty cold.
Oh, yeah. As long as it's getting below about 40 degrees
oh,
at
yeah
night or even 50
oh, yeah
in some cases,
oh, yeah
you're fine.
You're fine. So I'll
yeah
hang it. If not, I got to get it into a cooler. I'll put it into the larger cotton bags, the big
gotcha
the big bags, and I'll roll them up in there.
I started using the synthetic. I've got a mix now, I think, of a company out of Alaska, Tag Bags, and then the Caribou is the company. You can find those all over. I've got
some caribou. So yeah,
I was gonna warn people though. Wash them before you, especially with synthetic stuff.
Yes.
Wash it a handful of times, you know, make it a point. Hey, I'm going out scouting. Let me throw my synthetic game bags on, because that's another thing I've seen. And full disclosure, I actually did once. Luckily, it didn't ruin anything, but make sure you wash those things a couple times before you use those synthetic bags. So coming up after the break, let's get into a little bit more on warm weather meat care. Thanks for hanging in there over the break. Before we dive into kind of the pieces and parts quartering out and all that, I wanted to bring up, you brought up the Havilon Piranta, I think it's called.
Yeah, the Piranta, yeah.
I love those. I've got one. Free plug to Taito Knives. They make like a skeletonized handle that's super light, and I like it a little better than the stock folding configuration. But my brother and I got chatting, and he mentioned when they were doing an elk last year, how quickly the blades got dull.
Yes.
And I asked
him. Yeah, the Havilons. Yeah.
Yep. I asked him, what blades were they? And he said, he kind of looked at me like I was stupid and said, you know, the blades, the replacement. I said, no. Are they from Havilon, or are they an aftermarket? You bought them somewhere else. He said, no, just whatever you get through Havilon. Here's a tip for people. If you have one of those knives, I love them. Medical supply companies. Get the German made. It's that standard 60A size for like a scalpel.
Right. Yes. 60As, and then they're.
You'll pay, like, I forget what the price is through Havilon. You'll pay a lot less. You will get a lot less cuts out of the ones that come from the hunting companies.
Right.
Go to a medical supply company website. You can just Google like 60A surgical blades. And I forget, it's like a two-part German name. They'll be about twice the price. They last a lot longer.
Oh, okay.
So that's my tip for people. Like, if you're getting frustrated going, oh man, I can only get like half an elk hide off with these things, get an actual surgical grade blade from a medical supply company. It'll be much better.
As Henry stating, surgical blade. So I'm
telling you.
Be crazy careful with these.
Yep.
My nephew, we were out, got ourselves an elk, and he got careless, and that Havilon cut his thumb down to the bone.
Oh.
He was in there, and he's like prison shivving this thing. Not that I know what prison shivving looks like, but, you know, I've seen plenty of movies. And all of a sudden, he just screaming.
Oh.
Pulls his hand out, and his thumb was blade open, and we're back in there.
Yeah.
I'm like, dude,
be careful. Cut away from your hand.
Just be really, because they are so sharp. And then you've got that other knife, which I've used for bigger animals because of that purpose, the Havilon dulling so quick and going through like 3-4 blades to
per animal.
Elk. Yeah.
Yep.
Is the, what is it, Hunter Edge knife?
Oh, Hunter's Edge things?
Hunter's Edge
knife. Okay.
Yeah, because it's a little thicker blade, a little bit bigger. The Havilon, I use I think it's called a 7B blade, which is the rounded nose.
Oh, yeah, and smart.
I use that one for when I'm inside the animal or when I am skinning it.
Okay.
Because, you know, that 60A has got a nice point to it, and it always seems to be catching.
Puncturing something.
Puncturing things, and that's just no bueno.
Between that and I carry the same affixed blade in my kill kit. But I don't even do the bone saw anymore because I'll just work the joint.
That's what I do, yeah.
But that thicker blade, a thicker fixed blade and a thinner like a Havilon or a Taito with the surgical blades, that covers everything for me.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, we've done so many animals now that we know how to get that joint out.
Like, yes.
When you're younger, you're just sitting there just like flopping about with it, and that's, you pull the bone saw out and... But I don't like using the bone saws. They're just, to me, they're just a pain in the butt. And
agreed.
Just annoying. So, When you are breaking these animals down, though, there's six parts to what they call a traditional, what's called quartering an animal.
Right.
Got the two front legs, got the two hind quarters, you got the two loins, you know, the back straps, and then you will have what is the, like, all the secondary meat, like the remaining
red meat, neck meat,
yep. Some of the leg meat that's still on there. You know, if you choose to pull the meat from in between the ribs and stuff like that. So those are your six main components, your six main pieces. And as the animals are a little bit bigger, you want to, again, if it's warm out, you want to break those pieces down even more, or as we stated earlier, cut along the bone and open those pieces up, grab, you know, a piece of sagebrush stick or sticks or what have you, and to hold the meat separate.
Get some air in there.
Air in there. So, and then, make sure it's fairly clean and packed into the cloth and onto your frame pack.
And keep it off ice. If you are going straight into a cooler, I've done the Yeti coolers come with like a wire insert thing. I turn it sideways, flip it upside down, and put it on top of the ice, and it provides some standoff.
Yeah.
And anything you can do, you don't want, again, the big three, heat, moisture, well, I guess I should just call it big four, but heat, moisture, bugs, and bacteria. And that thing, you do not want it in a water permeable bag sitting, even if it's on ice, you don't want it soaking wet.
No, I built myself out of like 1/4-inch PVC.
Okay.
I created basically like a rack
in
my cooler. And the rack's large enough to where I can get bags of ice underneath it. And then I slide the rack over the ice and I make it tight enough to where, you know, the 1/4-inch PVC is strong enough to where then I can lay the meat on top of that and stays off of the ice, like you said, and out of the moisture.
Yeah, that moisture will turns meat funky. The popular thing, this is an Alaska thing, but they take a trash bag, put the quarter or whatever inside that, and then seal up the trash bag and dunk it in a creek.
Yeah.
That's fine as long as guys don't get the idea that you can do that just straight in the game in the meat bag.
No.
Don't do that.
No, it's going to be weird. Turn kind of a funky looking white cream color.
Grayish, nasty.
Then,
yeah.
Yeah. When you go to cook it, it probably tastes like toe jam or something.
Yeah. What's toe jam taste like? Yeah,
I don't know. I just thought of that. Like, you know, people are going to think that's kind of weird. Like, dude.
For people listening, whether it's your first season or your 15th, well, if it's your 15th, you probably know what you're doing by this point, or you've gone hungry every year and wasted meat. I don't know. But the meat pole thing, hanging and getting air circulation. People have complained. Another guy I was talking to, say he doesn't like mule deer. Okay, he doesn't hunt, so, you know, no harm, no foul. But man, the sooner you get that crust from airflow on the outside of the meat, it locks the moisture in. It's phenomenal. The whole goal of this thing is get the heat out, get the crust on, and then you'll be eating good after you got something.
I got a good friend who quit antelope hunting because he says it's the most disgusting meat that he's ever had in his life. I'm like, you've got to be nuts. That's like the best meat.
Yeah.
So I shot an antelope and processed it, took care of the meat real well, and had him over one evening, cooked him up some steaks and, you know, some other stuff and everything. He was like, this, cutting it with a fork is like, this was amazing. What was that? I'm like, it's antelope.
What had he been doing wrong? Did you ask?
Yeah. He was gutting the animal, leaving the hide on and stuff and throwing it in the back of the truck.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, well, there you go, dude.
It's cooking.
You're basically eating like half spoiled meat.
Yep.
And of course it's going to be gamey. It's going to be absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
So after he ate that, he started antelope hunting again, and he figured out how to care for the meat properly.
Right.
And now it's like his favorite meat. Like he goes to Wyoming and so he whacks antelope quite a bit.
That's his jam.
That's his jam. It's amazing how taking care of the meat effectively is going to change the game for you. As definitely get online, find out, you know, maybe what method works best for you, what your kill bag or kill kit should look like. Make sure you have it. I think I mentioned this in a show prior too, but I was out hunting and I came across a gentleman with his son.
Oh, this is a good story. Yeah.
And I was cruising by and I saw them up on the hill and I thought, well, man, maybe something's wrong because they're just standing up there looking around and just kind of like, I hike up there and ask him and he's like, well, my son just shot his first deer. And I was like, all right, congratulations. Shook the kid's hand and everything. I said, so what's going on? Do you guys need any help or something? He's like, well, we don't know what to do now. The first hunt, dad never hunted, took his son out the whole bit. And I'm like, well, we need to process the animal. I mean, yeah. you have a kill bag, you have like knives and stuff. He's like, no,
your fingernails are not that sharp, buddy.
Right. You know, he had a Leatherman. Was all he had was a leather.
Yeah.
So I ran down to my, you know, my side by side and ran back down the mountain, grabbed all my gear, came up and basically gave the gentleman and his son a course on what to do and the whole nine yards. And then I helped him pack it off and get it to his rig and the whole bit. It's that kind of thing where people sometimes just go out thinking, okay, all I need is my gun, some water, some granola bars, you know, a tent.
And then it'll show up wrapped in plastic on styrofoam.
Yeah.
That's not how it happens?
No, it's not. So hunting isn't as easy as people think, like maybe see it as.
Yeah, the entire process can be time consuming for sure.
Yeah, and it can be incredibly exhausting, and especially if you're like struggling the entire time.
Whoa, I just looked at the clock there, so it's time to go to break. Stick around through the break. Afterwards, I'll have some tips for sharpening your fingernails just in case you find yourself out there with no knives. And I almost forgot, happy Father's Day to all you dangerous dads out there. Hopefully you're out in the mountains right now scouting with your family. Hey, thanks for joining us again on Nevada Backcountry. David and I wanted to sit down and do a little bit of a preseason scouting talk. We've each kind of got our ways we go about it, but there are some things specific to Nevada we can get into. David, right off the bat, your first trip to a new area, or actually back up farther than that, you got a tag in your pocket.
Yes.
You know you're going to go scouting. What do you use for, we'll call it the hip thing now is e-scouting.
Yeah.
What are you looking for? And what do you use?
Well, so I use Onyx Hunt.
Okay.
I use that. I use Google Earth are my two primary ones. I've tried a few others like on the trial basis and stuff and found that Hunt Onyx is, you know, pretty much covers everything I need. And since I've got that subscription, I go for it. But I'll go through that and I will try to locate some key locations within my hunt units that I think would be, you know, huntable areas.
Okay.
You know, try to look for some good possible streams, some possible water sources, some good benches. You know, the map's only so good. You know, even the 3D ones you get down, it doesn't really give you that really nice definition. Basically, just it kind of narrows the mapping stuff kind of narrows it down. You know, a lot of our areas in the state of Nevada are huge. You know, Area 16 is immense. Area 10 is immense. You know, Ely area. I mean, there are huge areas, and trying to pick it apart by being on foot, you'd have to spend weeks out there, you know, traveling around. So it helps you narrow things down. So pretty much my first step is to familiarize myself through mapping the area that I'm going to be hunting.
I like Google Earth specifically for they have the sun feature.
Yes.
So if you open that, you can scroll through hours of the day, see how the sun kind of what little pockets of shade it creates and get a better idea of, okay, maybe this is where I need to be looking. But I was going to bring up the accuracy of Onyx. I'm a big time Onyx fan. I'm an Onyx user. I ran into this on that bear hunt with my brother. The one bummer about Onyx is it could be a two-track road used 40 years ago one time by a logging company, and they'll mark it as a road. And then when you actually get there, you realize, oh man, I just added 3.5-4 miles to my trip because this road is overgrown. It's non-existent.
It's gated.
Yeah. Bingo. Yeah. Yeah. So that's that thing. I'm like you. I do the same exact stuff with my e-scouting. I can't stress that enough. I really like that sun feature on Google Earth.
Yeah.
Hint, hint, Onyx.
No. It's really cool. Yeah. And then one of the big things I like with Onyx is the, you know, really checking for land ownership.
Oh, 100%.
You know,
yeah.
As we've mentioned on several episodes, the whole land disturbing my air, you know, lawsuits.
Yeah.
Stuff.
But, exactly.
But the beauty is with Nevada being so much of it is public land, a lot of people take that for granted and they just kind of go cruising through. And, you know, you'll get to a gate or something, a little sign there says, you know, closed gate. And you do it. Some don't. Some have nothing. And you go through it thinking it's still, you know, public land, and it's not. So that's another thing I kind of look at is if there are any private land ownership boundaries.
There's your e-scouting kind of in a nutshell. Now from there, you've got the places you want to go look at. What's your first trip into an area?
You know, my first trip into an area is, you know, getting my boots on the ground. It's taking, obviously, the pins that I've put on my map, obviously, beyond my phone, and try to get to those. As you stated, you might have some closed roads and stuff, but get in there and actually get my eyes on the landscape. So I'm going to get in there and I'm going to be looking for, I'm going to say we're hunting mule deer.
Okay.
That's the deal. We're going for mule deer. So I'm actually going to be looking for three of the main things: food, water, and habitat security. When I say habitat security, what I'm talking about is escape routes. Nice solid benches where that they'll feed on or they'll be bedded in, areas that can hold shade for a fair amount of the day. As we mentioned earlier off air was the cliffs, you know.
Oh, don't.
I love cliff faces because muleys really like to get up against the rocks.
And they'll bed right up against
it.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, even if you find a nice cliff face and there's a little pocket in there, or a big old chunk of rock came off or something, I've seen deer wedged back into some of these broken faces, and it's just, you know, they're in there. So
yeah, I don't know what that is. People tend to, I think the cliffs are high spots, and they go, okay, I want to get on top of that cliff and glass this sage flat,
right,
or whatever.
Down.
That's
glass happened to me
first.
That's actually happened to me before on a hunt, mule deer hunt. Is I went up to a cliff face and did not pay attention to directly below me. It was, I don't know, like 40 feet. I'm glassing, and I'm on the edge of this really nice canopy and not seeing anything. So I kind of sat down on the edge of the cliff and made a little noise. You know,
out comes some deer.
They were all bedded below me. I mean, they were right there, 40 feet below me, just bedded up against the rock. Yeah, so that was mistake number one. But, you know, then another thing I always look at is, what time of year am I hunting? What behavior are those animals going to be having?
Right.
You know
what
I mean? Like, mule deer bucks have no interest in does. None. Zero zip during archery season in Nevada. So if I see a big group of does, I'm not on like high alert thinking, okay, there's got to be a buck around.
Yeah.
I'm not hunting them in that time of the year. So I try to think about that. They're generally, and when you're hunting an archery, they're in bachelor groups. They're going to be a little bit higher generally than some of the does. By then, they'll have moved into their summer grounds, which is going to be higher elevation, you know, 5, 6, 7,000 feet-ish.
I like that window, about 6,000 to 8,500 feet for some reason. You know, those stands of mahogany and stuff. That's where I generally am going to find deer. Now, I'm not saying, you know, you talk to some of these people out there, Smith Valley, big ag areas,
yeah,
they'll have
be different.
Yeah, it'll be different, definitely. But generally speaking, if I'm out, we'll say like the wilderness up there, Jarbidge area, you know, I'm going to be looking at that 6,000 to 8,500 feet window, looking for stands of mahogany. And on that first trip, honestly, I'm not really even, if I stumble across deer, cool.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's purely a, how am I going to get in here? Where are some areas that I'm going to focus on my next trip?
Right. Yeah. Just completely agree there. Yeah. Just trying to get into some of these spots and see if they even have what deer are looking for.
If it checks the boxes.
If it checks the boxes. Yeah. And then usually on the second trip out is when deer become one of the priorities to to focus. Yeah, you know, obviously you want to see them on day on the first trip too.
Oh, but, yeah, that would be know, ideal.
That's super ideal, but the priority's a little different.
On my trips in there, this is something I've learned from mistakes I've made, but treat it like you're hunting. And by that, I mean, pay attention to the wind. Don't be out there yelling across a hill to each other, because you can and will blow out areas if you're constantly going in there like a bull in a china shop, stomping through prime bedding habitat. Let the glass, let your eyes do the walking for you, and focus more on, does this have all the stuff I need to find deer, versus let me see if I can sneak within 20 yards of a bedded deer right now.
Right.
So that's first trip in there. And then second trip, and pretty much every trip after, you know, it's that, okay, I've identified these spots. I know I want to put some time into them. Now I can start going in there and actually looking for deer. And I wanted to bring up the water thing. David, you might disagree with me. In certain units, man, if there's a spring in every draw, don't be that guy set up glassing the one spring that you think is just the magical one in that unit, or the one guzzler, because you're going to find there, if there's a ton of water, or if the food source is very good and full of water, they're not going to be hitting them that regularly.
No, not like a year like this year. I've already been out a few times out in the hills, and there is a lot of water. A lot of water everywhere. Will it be the same in August when the season starts? I don't know. It may or may not. Green up is looking pretty good right now. A lot of forbs and grasses and stuff are really doing well. But yeah, you know, if it's a really, really dry year and you've only got a water source or two water sources in a few basins that you've covered, you could probably hunt around it, and you're probably going to be pretty darn successful in locating deer. They'll probably hit it, not every day, maybe every second or third day they may be coming in. Years like now where they can literally drink just about anywhere, yeah, I totally agree with you. It would not be my number one thing to locate right now.
No. Thanks to Legacy Sports International, Out West Buildings, and Truck Envy for sponsoring the show today. If you drew a coveted rifle tag, you owe it to yourself to check out the Howa Superlight Rifles. Coming up at 11, you've got Tom Gresham's Gun Talk on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk.